Chairman Parkinson and all the rest of the members of our team here, delegates and fellow Californians, I'm sure you must realize without my saying it what a thrilling moment this is and what an honor you have done not only me but all of these people here to make us the standard bearers for the cause we represent. It's wonderfully thrilling to be back in Sacramento again, although I must confess some of the changes were a little disappointing. Arriving at the airport yesterday, I was sorry that Mr. Cranston wasn't there to meet me. I bet all of you saw the television in the last few days about the governor's fishing trip into the High Sierras, nonpartisan and nonpolitical. There was, however, one brief mention of the fact that the fish weren't biting, and he said they must be Republicans. That isn't true. They're just like all the rest of us in California. They've discovered that everything that's offered to them has a hook in it. You've met our team here, and we've talked throughout this convention about campaigning as a team. But there's something we haven't mentioned enough that's vitally important and goes beyond the campaign. And that is, we'll serve as a team in administering the affairs of this state. From Frank Jordan, our voice of experience, who unfortunately couldn't be with us here tonight, to our den mother, Ivy Baker Priest, who brings to us the prestige of the job that she held and the experience as the United States Treasurer, and who also brings to us and proves once again that ours is the party that represents all of the people. She is the first woman nominee for a constitutional office, I believe, in the state of California and in our history. Hugh Flournoy, experienced as a legislator, familiar with some of the most nagging problems that confront us in the state, particularly that problem that has to do with inheritance tax appraisers. I think he'll put an end to maintaining a personal army of political campaigners at public expense. And I think he'll ask some very real and pertinent questions, such as, will the real Mr. Cranston stand up? Yeah. With Spencer Williams as the Attorney General, it'll no longer be possible to have a quiet little $200 million tax scandal in California. The Attorney General says, oh, he had some suspicions about 10 years ago, but he just wasn't able to find anything. Two newspaper men from San Francisco could find it, and they didn't have an office directly across the hall from the assessor's office. Spence will inform the people of this state more fully in the days ahead, while his opponent will pretend that it didn't happen. And it's time that the people of California got their money's worth from the salaries paid some of their top executives. And with Bob Finch as lieutenant governor, this they will get. Right now, as we see the spectacle of a governor and a lieutenant governor who can't even agree on their future party's chairman, I pledge you that Bob Finch and I will work as partners full time. We're in complete agreement that the lieutenant governor shall take a major role in administering this state, and we'll put an end to silent salaried ghosts roaming through the halls of the State House. And while we're on this subject of the State House, let me also say, in answer to some of the things that might have been going around, that the fine public servants That great staff of career employees here in California will have nothing to fear from this state or this team. For too long and in too many instances, they've been limited in their service, their experience and their professional skill made virtually useless in instances by political hacks and cronies who have been appointed to executive positions above them in departments and areas where they had no experience or no knowledge of the departments they were supposed to administer. To the people of California and to these fine state employees, let's make one thing plain. We do not seek office to simply take over the patronage and the bureaucratic jungle created by the present administration. Wherever possible, we'll call upon the knowledgeable state employees, and in every case, appointments will be based on merit and not blood relationship. In short, we seek victory not for political expediency or pride of party, but to restore morality and dignity to government. But while we're here and jubilant in our mood, let's realize our task isn't easy. Within recent days, a meeting has been held in our state called by some of the sultans of labor. Hopefully, they thought the meeting was to be kept secret, but royalty can't travel incognito in this day of instant communications. So important was this meeting that even the leader of the airline strike left that battlefield to be present. And the plans were laid to raise an unprecedented $3 million for the California campaign. And much of this will not have to be reported as campaign contributions. It'll be classified as educational spending. But it'll hardly be spent in a nonpartisan way. Nor will the rank and file of labor be asked if its spending reflects their political thinking. Already, expensive slick paper brochures have appeared in labor papers or front-paging propaganda, much of it based on inaccuracies and outright falsehoods. Well, let's make one thing plain. When we speak of labor, and all of us should keep this in mind throughout the campaign, we must differentiate between the hierarchy, those professional bosses of labor, and the vast rank and file of the membership. Because that membership is made up of millions of honest, fair-minded, patriotic Americans. We have something to offer to them. Their own leadership no longer believes in their capacity to run their own affairs. One of the spokesmen, rather talented at creating whodunit fiction for cheap programs, Mr. Pitts, explained it when he said, "Any union member who doesn't vote as he's ordered to by union leadership is as guilty of being anti-labor as if he went through a picket line. It's an insult to every working man and every woman, and it would suggest that they are unable to exercise the sacred right to vote, and it reveals that Mr. Pitts has a strange idea indeed of what goes to make up this American society of ours. I happen to be of that rank and file of labor, member of two unions now and for more than 20 years, an officer, a board member, and six times president of one. I think I speak of labor from some background of experience. Some of those very sultans that conducted this meeting to plan our downfall have sat in my living room discussing the problems of labor when I held office. Now, I happen to believe in the right of labor to organize. I believe in collective bargaining. Much of the 20 years that I spent in those offices, I was in charge of collective bargaining for my own union. I sat across the table from the men who run our industry, and I know from experience that at any collective bargaining session, both parties at that table must sit at the table recognizing the right of the other, and must recognize also that there is someone with rights not represented at the table and depending upon both sides of the table to represent them and their rights, and that's the buying customer who can't be there. Now, whether it provokes controversy or not, let me make my position plain. It is my belief that the so-called right-to-work law is too big a gun for the problems we seek to solve. In 1958, I opposed that particular measure when it was advanced in California. I believe that a union and an industry or a business have a right to sit down and bargain and make a contract with each other. But I believe, since we have agreed, or I have agreed, in the right for a member to be compelled to join a union in order to practice the work or ply his trade, that he has a right to be protected within that union. And therefore, I will propose and do everything I can to get legislation passed that will guarantee to every union member in California the right on all policy matters in his union to a secret ballot. The first realistic legislation in the field of labor was passed in the administration of a Republican, Herbert Hoover. It was authored by Republicans. For years, there's been a no man's land that existed, an area of labor disputes that the federal government wouldn't touch, but it wouldn't let the states have jurisdiction. As a matter of fact, in 1957, the Supreme Court passed a decision that the states could not legislate in this field. It had been preempted by the federal government. In 1959, a Republican president, Dwight Eisenhower, asked that the states be given jurisdiction in that no man's land. This is the point where the governor of California lacked the foresight to see the problem area developing, and he lacked the leadership to push for the legislation to cover that no man's land. It'll be claimed that our Department of Industrial Relations and its Conciliation Service perform that function. But there is no machinery for carrying out the policy. Now, if the old governor had provided that machinery, such problems as the DiGiorgio election and the Delano disturbance couldn't have taken place. The new governor will ask for legislation to provide such machinery. A state Labor and Management Resources Act could ensure that both labor and management would be protected from unfair practices, so that the great resources, especially the human resources of our state, could be developed to the fullest. After fumbling for 8 years, the governor now wants to carry the ball for the next four, and he wants to carry it right to Washington, where he'll ask Big Brother to intervene in what should be a state matter where it concerns the workers of California. Now, we could go on in almost any direction, and we'd hit the same story. At one time, we bought land and built parks out of the general funds in our budget, and the budget was less than half the size it is now. Under this administration, we have taken out of the budget such spending. It's funded by bonds, but still 80% of the parkland that we own as a state is undeveloped because we don't have the money to develop it. But the budget has more than doubled. And now campaign oratory tells us in this election year that great park and recreation plans are in the offing, that already our parks are great as a result of what they've done, but which they'll be utopian in the next 4 years if you know what only happens. Well, a few years ago, we were told that we were going to make a human investment and in the Aid to Dependent Children program. This was going to be aimed at rehabilitation so that the need for that program would be eliminated, would just disappear, because everyone would be saved in the early days and made self-sufficient. Well, it's 5 years later, and there are more than 2.5 times as many children now being cared for by the Aid to Dependent Children program in California. 2.5 times as many as when the governor started to eliminate it. But if reelected, he has plans to retrain and rehabilitate the welfare recipients on a grand scale. Sometimes when you look at the past promises and the present promises and the lack of achievement, it reminds me of that very old story they tell about the fellow that was walking down the street and he buttonholed a friend and he said, "Say, did you hear about Charlie? He's just made a killing. Charlie, down in St. Louis, selling pants. He's made $50,000. And the friend says, "That's great. There are just a couple of mistakes there, though. I heard something about that. It wasn't Charlie, it was Bill. It wasn't St. Louis, it was Chicago. It wasn't pants he was selling, it was coats. And he didn't make $50,000, he lost $50,000. We laugh, but doesn't it hurt a little bit? This morning when we were meeting over there in that magnificent historic Capitol building, so representative of the greatness of our state, I felt the enormous challenge that's ours to see that we restore, even in our campaigning, and certainly in our conduct in office, if we should be put there by the people of California, some measure of dignity that's been lacking for such a long time. No member of this team, no member will ever be found scurrying around town, photographer in tow, smear sheet in hand, like a freshman at a fraternity initiation. A few days ago, the governor's office called Washington. A phone call was put in to Senator Williams by Mr. Dutton, who's managing the governor's campaign. And he suggested that it might be a good idea, the governor would appreciate it, if Senator Williams would come, oh, later on in the campaign to California and campaign for the governor. And then it was pointed out that perhaps Senator Williams might be able to have another agricultural subcommittee meeting out here at the time, and thus he could write the expenses of the trip off against the Congress. And Senator Williams said he'd be very happy to campaign in California, and he'd pay his own expenses, and his subject would be honest government. You see, Mr. Dutton had made a slight mistake. He didn't have Democratic Senator Williams of New Jersey on the phone. He had Republican Senator Williams of Delaware, the man who uncovered the Bobby Baker case. It doesn't always take outright graft and corruption to destroy honesty in government. The luster can be dimmed by those in office who seek no wrong or see no wrong, with a University of California regent serving at the same time as a campaign manager for the state's chief executive, while a second regent approaches University of California professors and enlists them in that same campaign to help the governor with campaign issues. Or when the president of that university sends out a statewide mailing which, while it mentions no candidate by name, is nonetheless a thinly disguised partisan piece slanted toward the candidacy of the incumbent governor. Honesty is eroded just a little bit when administrative appointees receive cards reminding them of their salary and telling them of the minimum campaign contribution that will be acceptable and the maximum that will be desirable. And the governor describes their response as, quote, a wonderful manifestation of voluntary interest in good government. State agencies are ordered to come up with campaign documents glorifying this administration at the taxpayer's expense, preferably by September. And appointments are made not on merit, but to repay political favors. And the arrogance that comes from power too long is evidence when the governor is elected, who is elected to represent all of the people, says of even a majority of the citizens he represents when they happen to oppose his will, that they are shock troops of bigotry, echoes of Nazi Germany, echoes of another hate binge which began more than 30 years ago in a Munich beer hall. This is extreme phraseology from one who professes to deplore extremism. I've recently received a letter from William Warney. Mr. Warney was formerly associated with our federal overseas giveaways. He's now the director of the California Water Resources Program. It was probably thought that he'd have less trouble keeping track of California water than he did of the liquid assets of foreign aid. Mr. Warney's letter is a paean of praise for the governor's single-handed triumph in pushing and persuading the California legislature about the value of water.
He refers to all the blessings which will flow from Governor Brown's water project. One has almost a fear that when the governor leaves office, he'll take his water with him. The very least that we can expect is that when this great project is completed, the governor will celebrate its completion by journeying across the surface of each sparkling lake and down the surface of each canal on foot. Now, it may come as quite a shock to them, but believe it or not, I do know the difference between the Eel and the Feather Rivers. I know that most of us incorrectly use the Feather River Project, that term, to describe the California Water Plan, of which the Feather River Project is only the first unit. But I wonder if Mr. Warney knows that Governor Brown's water program is in its entirety printed over the signature of Governor Goodwin Knight because it was produced entirely in his administration. All this erosion of honesty, this abandonment of principle, this arrogance, is the inevitable result of an administration that has grown tired and stale in office. Well, it need not happen again. As the governor, and I believe I can say with confidence, with virtually the full support of this team, I will seek whatever legislation is necessary to henceforth limit any and all governors of California constitutionally to no more than 2 terms in office. Now, since this seems too short a time for a man who likes to refer to himself as not only a good governor, but a great governor, I think he should remember that 2 terms by constitutional amendment is long enough for any president of the United States. If a man can't do the job in 8 years, what makes us think he can do it in 12? But seriously, I believe that such legislation would testify to the underlying belief and principle of our party. Not that we just oppose some particular individual as having too much power or being around too long, but that we basically believe that power endangers the freedom of the people when it is entrusted into the hands of anyone but the people, and that no individual or group, including ourselves, must be allowed to endanger that trust. Now, the days ahead are going to be very hard for all of us. On Thursday last, Mr. Coate, the Democratic chairman, issued an announcement that in the coming week, he will come forth with an exposure to the people of California. It'll be directed, I believe, according to his pregame announcement, to me. Now, I haven't seen what he's going to issue in this coming week, but 5 will get you 10. I could have written it myself. It'll be an exercise in guilt by association. You will learn, for example, that speeches I've made back through the years have been reprinted in the publications of organizations who advocate bigotry and prejudice. They have been taped, and those tapes have been played at the meetings of such organizations. No question about it, this is true. It's true because anyone who expresses himself publicly from a platform of this kind must expect that his words can be used and repeated or reprinted by anyone. Once they're uttered, there can be no restriction on those who would reproduce them, nor would we have it any other way if we value freedom of speech and press. Now, I retract no statements of mine that I've made in the past. My principles remain what they always have been. I will stand behind all of the quotes if they're honestly and completely quoted, which I seriously doubt will be the case by Mr. Choate. And at the same time that I stand behind all the things I've said back through the years about the need for constitutional limits and the power of government, on my deep-seated belief in the right of the people to control their own destiny, I repudiate bigotry and prejudice and racism and all those who are guided by it. But I will not join Mr. Choate or Mr. Cranston or any of the other hatchet men of the Brown machine in debating smears that are designed to divert the people's attention from the failures of this administration. They will stand before us. They don't dare campaign on their record. They have to campaign on personally vilifying those who oppose them. We will not answer back. It won't be necessary. And then late in October, they'll stand before us, dripping mud from their arms up to the elbows, and we'll hear the words that we've heard twice before: "This is the dirtiest campaign in my entire political history." And they'll be talking of themselves. Because we're not going to do that. Because here in this state, even though we stand as a Republican Party, we're not selling our party name to the people of California. We're not selling any idea of changing party loyalty. The thing that has happened and that they seem to be so unaware of is that all through this state, there are millions of Californians, honest, patriotic citizens, Democrats, independents, and Republicans. They are sick and tired of being treated as mentally incompetent, unable to understand the issues. They're sick and tired of having some bigot appeal to them with demagoguery and name-calling. They want someone to come before them, appreciate their intelligence, and discuss the issues that concern all of us in this state. This is a campaign promise I know I can make on behalf of all who sit up here on this team. We are going to campaign on those issues. We are going to tell the people of California as well as we can what our solution to those problems will be. And when we have done that, we won't have to come around after the votes have been counted and apologize for what we said during the campaign because we really didn't mean it and we just don't know how it happened at the time. And when we have campaigned the way we intend to campaign, we can make another campaign promise, and that is that the next time you and I and all of us gather here in Sacramento, it will be for the inauguration. Yeah. Thank you very much.